was, why turn up at all? Because it was worth it, for some purpose of her own. And if she wasn't a spoiled bitch, she must have been in some kind of emotional state that made her act out of character. There's a living witness to the fact that Lula begged somebody, over the phone, to come and see her, at her flat, sometime after 1 in the morning. There's also that piece of blue paper she had before she went into Vashti, and which nobody is admitting to having seen since. What did she do with it? Why was she writing in the back of the car before she saw Rochelle? It could have been, said Wardle. It wasn't a fucking shopping list, groaned Strike, thumping the desk. And nobody writes a suicide note 8 hours in advance and then goes dancing. She was writing a bloody will! Don't you get it? She took it into Vashti to get Rochelle to witness it. Bollocks, said Carver yet again. But Strike ignored him, addressing Wardle. Which fits with her telling Kiara Porter that she was going to leave everything to her brother, doesn't it? She just made it legal. It was on her mind. Why suddenly make a will? Strike hesitated and sat back. Carver leered at him. Imagination run out. Strike let out his breath in a long sigh. An uncomfortable night of alcohol-sodden unconsciousness. Last night's pleasurable excesses. Half a cheese and pickle sandwich in 12 hours. He felt hollowed out, exhausted. If I had hard evidence, I'd have brought it to you. The odds of people close to a suicide killing themselves go right up. Did you know that? This Raquel was a depressive. She has a bad day, remembers the way out her mate took, and does a copycat jump. Which leads us right back to you, pal, persecuting people and pushing them over the edge. Yeah, said Strike. People keep saying that. Very poor fucking taste in the circumstances. What about Tansy Bastigui's evidence? How many times, Strike? We proved she couldn't have heard it, Wardle said. We proved it beyond doubt. No, you didn't, said Strike, finally, when he least expected it, losing his temper. You based your whole case on one almighty fuck-up. If you'd taken Tansy Bastigui seriously, if you'd broken her down and got her to tell you the whole fucking truth, Rochelle Onifade would still be alive. Pulsating with rage, Carver kept Strike there for another hour. His last act of contempt was to tell Wardle to make sure he saw Rokeby Jr. firmly off the premises. Wardle walked Strike to the front door, not speaking. I need you to do something, said Strike, halting at the exit, beyond which they could see the darkening sky. You've had enough from me already, mate, said Wardle, with a wry smile. I'm going to be dealing with that. He jerked his thumb over his shoulder towards Carver and his temper. For days because of you. I told you it was suicide. Wardle, unless someone brings the fucker in, there are 2 more people in danger of being knocked off. Strike, what if I bring you proof that Tansy Bastigui wasn't in her flat at all when Lula fell? That she was somewhere she could have heard everything? Wardle looked up towards the ceiling and closed his eyes momentarily. If you've got proof, I haven't. But I will have in the next couple of days. 2 men walked past them, talking, laughing. Wardle shook his head, looking exasperated, and yet he did not turn away. If you want something from the police, call Anstice. He's the one who owes you. Anstice can't do this for me. I need you to call D.B. Mack.
What the fuck?
You heard me. He's not going to take my calls, is he? But he'll speak to you. You've got the authority. And it sounds as though he likes you. You're telling me D.B. Mack knows where Tansy Bastigui was when Lula Landry died? No, of course he bloody doesn't. He was in barrack. I want to know what clothes he got sent on from Kentigern Gardens to Claridge's. Specifically, what stuff he got from Guy Sommet. Strike did not pronounce the name Guy for Wardle.
You want... Why?
Because one of the runners on that CCTV footage was wearing one of DB's sweatshirts. Wardle's expression, arrested for a moment, relapsed into exasperation.
"You see that stuff everywhere,"
he said after a moment or two. "That GS stuff, shell suits, trackies." This was a customized hoodie. There was only one of them in the world. "Call DB and ask him what he got from Sumay. That's all I need." "Whose side do you want to be on if it turns out I'm right, Wardle?"
"Don't threaten me, Strike."
"I'm not threatening you. I'm thinking about a multiple murderer who's walking around out there planning the next one. But if it's the papers you're worried about, I don't think they're going to go too easy on anyone who clung to the suicide theory once another body surfaced. Call DB Matt Wardle before someone else gets killed." Chapter 11. "No," said Strike forcefully, on the telephone that evening. "This is getting dangerous. Surveillance doesn't fall within the scope of secretarial duties." "Nor did visiting the Malmaison Hotel in Oxford, or SOAS," Robin pointed out. "But you were happy enough that I did both of them." "You're not following anyone, Robin. I doubt Matthew would be very happy about it either." It was funny, Robin thought, sitting in her dressing gown on her bed, with the phone pressed to her ear, how Strike had retained the name of her fiancé without ever having met him. In her experience, men did not usually bother to log that kind of information. Matthew frequently forgot people's names, even that of his newborn niece, but she supposed that Strike must have been trained to recall such details. "I don't need Matthew's permission," she said. "Anyway, it wouldn't be dangerous. You don't think Ursula Mays killed anyone?" There was an inaudible, "do you?" at the end of the sentence. "No, but I don't want anyone to hear I'm taking an interest in her movements. It might make the killer nervous, and I don't want anyone else thrown from a height." Robin could hear her own heart thumping through the thin material of her dressing gown. She knew that he would not tell her who he thought the killer was. She was even a little frightened of knowing, notwithstanding the fact that she could think of nothing else. It was she who had called Strike. Hours had passed since she had received a text saying that he had been compelled to go with the police to Scotland Yard and asking her to lock up the office behind her at 5. Robin had been worried. "Call him, then, if he's going to keep you awake," Matthew had said, not quite snapping, not quite indicating that he was, without knowing any of the details, firmly on the side of the police. "Listen, I want you to do something for me," said Strike. "Call John Bristow first thing tomorrow and tell him about Rochelle." "All right," said Robin, with her eyes on the large stuffed elephant Matthew had given her on their first Valentine's Day together 8 years previously. The present giver himself was watching Newsnight in the sitting room. "What are you going to be doing?" "I'm going to be on my way to Pinewood Studios for a few words with Freddie Bastigui."
"How?"
said Robin.
"They won't let you near him."
"Yeah, they will," said Strike. After Robin had hung up, Strike sat motionless for a while in his dark office. The thought of the semi-digested McDonald's meal lying inside Rochelle's bloated corpse had not prevented him consuming 2 Big Macs, a large box of fries, and a McFlurry on the way back from Scotland Yard. Gassy noises from his stomach were now mingling with the muffled thuds of the bass from the 12-bar cafe, which Strike barely noticed these days. The sound might have been his own pulse. Kiara Porter's messy, girlish flat, her wide, groaning mouth, the long white legs wrapped tightly around his back, belonged to a life lived long ago. All his thoughts now were for squat and graceless Rochelle Onifade. He remembered her talking fast into her phone, not 5 minutes after she had left him, dressed in exactly the same clothes she had been wearing when they pulled her out of the river. He was sure he knew what had happened. Rochelle had called the killer to say that she had just lunched with a private detective. A meeting had been arranged over her glittering pink phone. That night, after a meal or a drink, they had sauntered through the dark towards the river. He thought of Hammersmith Bridge, sage green and gold, in the area where she claimed to have a new flat.
a famous suicide spot, with its low sides and the fast-flowing Thames below. She could not swim. Nighttime. Two lovers play-fighting, a car sweeps by, a scream and a splash. Would anyone have seen? Not if the killer had ironclad nerves and a liberal dash of luck. And this was a murderer who had already demonstrated plenty of the former and an unnerving, reckless reliance on the latter. Defending counsel would undoubtedly argue diminished responsibility because of the vainglorious overreaching that made Strike's quarry unique in his experience. And perhaps, he thought, there was some pathology there, some categorizable madness, but he was not much interested in the psychology. Like John Bristow, he wanted justice. In the darkness of his office, his thoughts veered suddenly and unhelpfully back in time to the most personal death of all. The one that Lucy assumed, quite wrongly, haunted Strike's every investigation, coloured every case. The killing that had fractured his and Lucy's lives into two epochs, so that everything in their memory was cleaved clearly into what had happened before their mother died and that which had happened afterwards. Lucy thought he had run away to join the RMP because of Leader's death, that he had been driven to it by his unsatisfied belief in his stepfather's guilt, that every corpse he saw in the course of his professional life must recall their mother to his mind, that every killer he met must seem to be an echo of their stepfather, that he was driven to investigate other deaths in an eternal act of personal exculpation. But Strike had aspired to this career long before the last needle had entered Leader's body, long before he had understood that his mother, and every other human, was mortal, and that killings were more than puzzles to be solved. It was Lucy who never forgot, who lived in a swarm of memories like coffin flies, who projected onto any and all unnatural deaths the conflicting emotions aroused in her by their mother's untimely demise. Tonight, however, he found himself doing the very thing that Lucy was sure must be habitual. He was remembering Leader and connecting her to this case. Leader Strike, super groupie. It was how they always captioned her in the most famous photograph of all, and the only one that featured his parents together. There she was, in black and white, with her heart-shaped face, her shining dark hair, and her marmoset eyes. And there, separated from each other by an art dealer, an aristocratic playboy, one since dead by his own hand, the other of AIDS, and Carla Astolfi, his father's second wife, was Johnny Rokeby himself, androgynous and wild, hair nearly as long as Leader's, martini glasses and cigarettes, smoke curling out of the model's mouth, but his mother more stylish than any of them. Everyone but Strike had seemed to view Leader's death as the deplorable but unsurprising result of a life lived perilously beyond societal norms. Even those who had known her best and longest were satisfied that she herself had administered the overdose they found in her body. His mother, by almost unanimous consent, had walked too close to the unsavoury edges of life, and it was only to be expected that she would one day topple out of sight and fall to her death, stiff and cold, on a filthy sheeted bed. Why she had done it, nobody could quite explain. Not even Uncle Ted, silent and shattered, leaning against the kitchen sink, or Aunt Joan, red-eyed but angry at her little kitchen table, with her arms around 19-year-old Lucy, who was sobbing into Joan's shoulder. An overdose had simply seemed consistent with the trend of Leader's life, with the squats and the musicians and the wild parties, with the squalor of her final relationship and home, with the constant presence of drugs in her vicinity, with her reckless quest for thrills and highs. Strike alone had asked whether anyone had known his mother had taken to shooting up. He alone had seen a distinction between her predilection for cannabis and a sudden liking for heroin. He alone had unanswered questions and saw suspicious circumstances. But he had been a student of 20, and nobody had listened. After the trial and the conviction, Strike had packed up and left everything behind. The short-lived burst of press, Aunt Joan's desperate disappointment at the end of his Oxford career, Charlotte, bereft and incensed by his disappearance and already sleeping with someone new, Lucy's screams and scenes. With the sole support of Uncle Ted, he had vanished into the army, and refound there the life he had been taught by Leda, constant uprootings, self-reliance, and the endless appeal of the new. Tonight, though, he could not help seeing his mother as a spiritual sister to the beautiful, needy, and depressive girl who had broken apart on a frozen road, and to the plain, homeless outsider now lying in the chilly morgue. Leda, Lula, and Rochelle had not been women like Lucy or his Aunt Joan. They had not taken every reasonable precaution against violence or chance. They had not tethered themselves to life with mortgages and voluntary work, safe husbands and clean-faced dependents. Their deaths, therefore, were not classed as tragic in the same way as those of staid and respectable housewives. How easy it was to capitalize on a person's own bent for self-destruction. How simple to nudge them into non-being, then to stand back and shrug, and agree that it had been the inevitable result of a chaotic, catastrophic life. Nearly all the physical evidence of Lula's murder had long since been wiped away, trodden underfoot or covered by thickly falling snow. The most persuasive clue Strike had was, after all, that grainy black-and-white footage of two men running away from the scene. A piece of evidence given a cursory check and tossed aside by the police, who were convinced that nobody could have entered the building, that Landry had committed suicide, and that the film showed nothing more than a pair of larcenous loiterers with intent. Strike roused himself and looked at his watch. It was 10:30, but he was sure the man to whom he wished to speak would be awake. He flicked on his desk lamp, took up his mobile and dialed, this time a number in Germany.
"Oggy!" bellowed the tinny voice on the other end of the phone. "How the fuck are you? Need a favour, mate?"
And Strike asked Lieutenant Graham Hardacre to give him all the information he could find on one Agumon of the Royal Engineers, Christian name and rank unknown, but with particular reference to the dates of his tours of duty in Afghanistan. Chapter 12. It was only the second car he had driven since his leg had been blown off. He had tried driving Charlotte's Lexus, but today, trying not to feel in any way emasculated, he had hired an automatic Honda Civic. The journey to Ivor Heath took under an hour. Entrance into Pinewood Studios was effected by a combination of fast talk, intimidation, and the flashing of genuine, though outdated, official documentation. The security guard, initially impassive, was rocked by Strike's air of easy confidence, by the words "Special Investigation Branch," by the pass bearing his photograph.
"Have you got an appointment?" he asked Strike,
feet above him in the box beside the electric barrier, his hand covering the telephone receiver.
"No." "What's it about?"
"Mr. Evan Duffield," said Strike, and he saw the security guard scowl as he turned away and muttered into the receiver. After a minute or so, Strike was given directions and waved through. He followed a gently winding road around the outskirts of the studio building, reflecting again on the convenient uses to which some people's reputation for chaos and self-destruction could be put. He parked a few rows behind a chauffeured Mercedes, occupying a space with a sign in it reading, "Producer Freddy Bestigui," made his unhurried exit from the car while Bestigui's driver watched him in the rearview mirror, and proceeded through a glass door that led to a nondescript, institutional set of stairs. A young man was jogging down them, looking like a slightly tidier version of Spanner.
"Where can I find Mr. Freddy Bestigui?"
Strike asked him.
"Second floor, first office on the right."
He was as ugly as his pictures. Bull-necked and pockmarked, sitting behind a desk on the far side of a glass partition wall, scowling at his computer monitor. The outer office was busy and cluttered, full of attractive young women at desks. Film posters were tacked to pillars and photographs of pets were pinned up beside film schedules. The pretty girl nearest the door, who was wearing a switchboard microphone in front of her mouth, looked up at Strike and said, "Hello, can I help you?"
"I'm here to see Mr. Bestigui. Not to worry, I'll see myself in."
He was inside Bestigui's office before she could respond. Bestigui looked up, his eyes tiny between pouches of flesh, black moles sprinkled over the swarthy skin.
"Who are you?"
He was already pushing himself up, thick-fingered hands clutching the edge of his desk.
"I'm Cormoran Strike. I'm a private detective. I've been hired..." "Elena!"
Bestigui knocked his coffee over. It was spreading out across the polished wood into all his papers.
"Get the fuck out! Out! Out!
I Lula Landry's brother, John Bristow."
"Elena!"
The pretty thin girl wearing the headset ran inside and stood fluttering beside Strike, terrified.
"Call security, you dozy little bitch!"
She ran outside. Bestigui, who was 5 feet 6 inches at the most, had pushed his way out from behind his desk now, as unafraid of the enormous Strike as a pit bull whose yard had been invaded by a Rottweiler. Elena had left the door open. The inhabitants of the outer office were staring in, frightened, mesmerized.
"I've been trying to get hold of you for a few weeks, Mr. Bestigui."
"You are in a shitload of trouble, my friend," said Bestigui,
advancing with a set jaw, his thick shoulders braced.
"To talk about the night Lula Landry died."
Two men in white shirts and carrying walkie-talkies were running along the glass wall to Strike's right, young, fit, tense-looking.
"Get him out of here!"
Bestigui roared, pointing at Strike, as the two guards bounced off each other in the doorway, then forced their way inside.
"Specifically," said Strike, "about the whereabouts of your wife, Tansy, when Lula fell."
"Get him out of here and call the fucking police! How did he get in here?"
"Because I've been shown some photographs that make sense of your wife's testimony."
"Get your hands off me,"
Strike added to the younger of the guards, now tugging his upper arm, "or I'll knock you through that window." The security guard did not let go, but looked towards Bestigui for instructions. The producer's bright dark eyes were fixed intently on Strike. He clenched and relaxed his thug's hands. After several long seconds, he said,
"You're full of shit."
But he did not instruct the waiting guards to drag Strike from his room. "The photographer was standing on the pavement opposite your house in the early hours of the 8th of January.
The guy who took the pictures doesn't realize what he's got."
"If you don't want to discuss it, fine. Police or press, I don't care. It'll come to the same thing in the end."
Strike took a few steps towards the door. The guards, each of whom was still holding him by the arm, were caught by surprise and momentarily forced into the absurd position of holding him back.
"Get out," Bestigui said abruptly to his minions. "I'll let you know if I need you. Close the door behind you."
They left. When the door had closed, Bestigui said,
"All right, whatever your fucking name is. You can have 5 minutes.
Strike sat down, uninvited, in one of the black leather chairs facing Bestigui's desk, while the producer returned to his seat behind it, subjecting Strike to a hard, cold glare that was quite unlike the one Strike had received from Bestigui's estranged wife. This was the intense scrutiny of a professional gambler. Bestigui reached for a packet of cigarillos, pulled a black glass ashtray towards himself, and lit up with a gold lighter.
"All right, let's hear what these alleged photographs show," he said,
squinting through clouds of pungent smoke, the picture of a film mafioso. "The silhouette," said Strike, "of a woman crouching on the balcony outside your sitting room windows. She looks naked, but as you and I know, she was in her underwear." Bestigui puffed hard for a few seconds, then removed the cigarillo and said,
"Bullshit. You couldn't see that from the street. Solid stone bottom of the balcony. From that angle, you wouldn't see anything. You're taking a punt."
"The lights were on in your sitting room. You can see her outline through the gaps in the stone. There was room then, of course, because the shrubs weren't there, were they?
People can't resist fiddling with a scene afterwards, even when they've got away with it, Strike added conversationally. You were trying to pretend that there was never any room for anyone to squat on that balcony, weren't you? But you can't go back and Photoshop reality. Your wife was perfectly positioned to hear what happened up on the third floor balcony just before Lula Landry died. Here's what I think happened, Strike went on, while Bastigui continued to squint through the smoke rising from his cigarillo. You and your wife had a row while she was undressing for bed. Perhaps you found her stash in the bathroom, or you interrupted her doing a couple of lines. So you decided an appropriate punishment would be to shut her outside on the sub-zero balcony. People might ask how a street full of paps didn't notice a part-naked woman being shoved out on a balcony over their heads. But the snow was falling very thickly, and they'll have been stamping their feet, trying to keep the circulation going, and their attention was focused on the ends of the street, while they were waiting for Lula and D.B. Mack. And Tansy didn't make any noise, did she? She ducked down and hid. She didn't want to show herself half-naked in front of 30 photographers. You might even have shoved her out there at the same time that Lula's car came round the corner. Nobody would have been looking at your windows if Lula Landry had just appeared in a skimpy little dress. You're full of shit, said Bastigui. You haven't got any photographs. I never said I had them. I said I'd been shown them. Bastigui took the cigarillo from his lips, changed his mind about talking, and replaced it. Strike allowed several moments to elapse, but when it became clear that Bastigui was not going to avail himself of the opportunity to speak, he continued. Tansy must have started hammering on the window immediately after Landry fell past her. You weren't expecting your wife to start screaming and banging on the glass, were you? Understandably averse to anyone witnessing your bit of domestic abuse, you opened up. She ran straight past you, screaming her head off, out of the flat, and downstairs to Derek Wilson. At which point, you looked down over the balustrade and saw Lula Landry lying dead in the street below. Bastigui puffed smoke slowly, without taking his eyes off Strike's face. What you did next might seem quite incriminating to a jury. You didn't dial 999. You didn't run after your half-frozen hysterical wife. You didn't even, which the jury might find more understandable, run and flush away the coke you knew was lying in open view in the bathroom. No. What you did next, before following your wife or calling the police, was to wipe that window clean. There'd be no prints to show that Tansy had placed her hands on the outside of the glass, would there? Your priority was to make sure that nobody could prove you had shoved your wife out onto a balcony in a temperature of -10. What with your unsavoury reputation for assault and abuse, and the possibility of a lawsuit from a young employee in the air, you weren't going to hand the press or a prosecutor any additional evidence, were you? Once you'd satisfied yourself that you'd removed any trace of her prints from the glass, you ran downstairs and compelled her to return to your flat. In the short time available to you before the police arrived, you bullied her into agreeing not to admit where she'd been when the body fell. I don't know what you promised her or threatened her with, but whatever it was, it worked. You still didn't feel completely safe, though, because she was so shocked and distressed you thought she might blurt out the whole story. So you tried to distract the police by ranting about the flowers that had been knocked over in D.B. Mack's flat, hoping Tansy would pull herself together and stick to the deal. Well, she has, hasn't she? God knows how much it's cost you, but she's let herself be dragged through the dirt in the press. She's put up with being called a coke-addled fantasist. She's stuck to her cock-and-bull story about hearing Landry and the murderer argue through two floors and soundproofed glass. Once she realizes there's photographic proof of where she was, though,
said Strike. I think she'll be glad to come clean. Your wife might think she loves money more than anything in the world, but her conscience is troubling her. I'm confident she'll crack pretty fast.
Bestigui had smoked his cigarillo down to its last few millimeters. Slowly he ground it out in the black glass ashtray. Long seconds passed, and the noise in the outside office filtered through the glass wall beside them. Voices, the ringing of a telephone. Bestigui stood up and lowered Roman blinds of canvas down over the glass partition so that none of the nervy girls in the office beyond could see in. He sat back down and ran thick fingers thoughtfully over the crumpled terrain of his lower face, glancing at Strike and away again towards the blank cream canvas he had created. Strike could almost see options occurring to the producer as though he was riffling a deck of cards.
"The curtains were drawn," Bestigui said finally. "There wasn't enough light coming out of the windows to make out a woman hiding on the balcony. Tansy's not going to change her story."
"I wouldn't bet on that," said Strike, stretching out his legs. The prosthesis was still uncomfortable.
"When I put it to her that the legal term for what the pair of you have done is conspiring to pervert the course of justice, and that a belated show of conscience might keep her out of the nick, when I add in the public sympathy she's bound to get as the victim of domestic abuse, and the amount of money she's likely to be offered for exclusive rights to her story, when she realizes she's going to get her say in court, and that she'll be believed, and that she'll be able to bring about the conviction of the man she heard murdering her neighbor, Mr. Bestigui, I don't think even you've got enough money to keep her quiet."
The coarse skin around Bestigui's mouth flickered. He picked up his packet of cigarillos, but did not extract one. There was a long silence, during which he turned the packet between his fingers, round and round. At last he said,
"I'm admitting nothing. Get out."
Strike did not move.
"I know you're keen to phone your lawyer," he said. "But I think you're overlooking the silver lining here. I've had enough of you. I said, get out. However unpleasant it's going to be, having to admit to what happened that night, it's still preferable to becoming the prime suspect in a murder case. It's going to be about the lesser of evils from here on in. If you cough to what really happened, you're putting yourself in the clear for the actual murder."
He had Bestigui's attention now.
"You couldn't have done it," said Strike. "Because if you'd been the one who threw Landry off the balcony 2 floors above, you wouldn't have been able to let Tansy back inside within seconds of the body falling. I think you shut your wife outside, headed off into the bedroom, got into bed, got comfy." The police said the bed looked disarranged and slept in. "And kept an eye on the clock. I don't think you wanted to fall asleep. If you'd left her too long on that balcony, you'd have been up for manslaughter. No wonder Wilson said she was shaking like a whippet. Probably in the early stages of hypothermia."
Another silence, except for Bestigui's fat fingers drumming lightly on the edge of the desk. Strike took out his notebook.
"Are you ready to answer a few questions now?" "Fuck you."
The producer was suddenly consumed by the rage he had so far suppressed, his jaw jutting and his shoulders hunched, level with his ears. Strike could imagine him looking thus as he bore down on his emaciated, coked-up wife, hands outstretched.
"You're in the shit here," said Strike calmly. "But it's entirely up to you how deep you sink. You can deny everything, battle it out with your wife in the court and the papers, end up in jail for perjury and obstructing the police. Or you can start cooperating right now and earn Lula's family's gratitude and goodwill. That'd go a long way to demonstrating remorse, and it'll help when it comes to pleas for clemency. If your information helps catch Lula's killer, I can't see you getting much worse than a reprimand from the bench.
It's going to be the police who'll get the real going over from the public and the press.
Bastigui was breathing noisily, but seemed to be pondering Strike's words.
At last, he snarled, there wasn't any fucking killer. Wilson never found anyone up there. Landry jumped, he said, with a small, dismissive jerk of his head. She was a fucked-up little druggie, like my fucking wife.
There was a killer, said Strike simply, and you helped him get away with it.
Something in Strike's expression stifled Bastigui's clear urge to jeer. His eyes were slits of onyx as he mulled over what Strike had said.
I've heard you were keen to put Lula in a film.
Bastigui seemed disconcerted by the change of subject.
It was just an idea, he muttered. She was a flake, but she was fucking gorgeous. You fancied getting her and D.B. Mack into a film together. License to print money, those two together.
What about this film you've been thinking of making since she died?
What do they call it? A biopic. I hear Tony Landry wasn't happy about it.
To Strike's surprise, a satyr's grin impressed itself on Bastigui's pouchy face.
Who told you that? Isn't it true?
For the first time, Bastigui seemed to feel he had the upper hand in the conversation.
No, it's not true. Anthony Landry has given me a pretty broad hint that once Lady Bristow's dead, he'll be happy to talk about it.
He wasn't happy then, when he called you to talk about it.
As long as it's tastefully handled, yada yada.
Do you know Tony Landry well?
I know of him. In what context?
Bastigui scratched his chin, smiling to himself.
He's your wife's divorce lawyer, of course.
For now he is, said Bastigui.
You think she's going to sack him?
She might have to, said Bastigui,
and the smile became a self-satisfied leer.
Conflict of interest, we'll see.
Strike glanced down at his notebook, considering, with the gifted poker player's dispassionate calculation of the odds, how much risk there was in pushing this line of questioning to the limit on no proof.
Do I take it, he said, looking back up, that you've told Landry you know he's sleeping with his business partner's wife?
One moment stunned surprise, and then Bastigui laughed out loud, a boorish, aggressive blast of glee.
Know that, do you?
How did you find out?
I hired one of your lot. I thought Tansy was doing the dirty, but it turned out she was giving alibis to her bloody sister, while Ursula was having it away with Tony Landry. It'll be a shitload of fun to watch the Mays divorcing. High-powered lawyers on both sides, old family firm broken up. Cyprian Mays, not as limp as he looks. He represented my second wife. I'm going to have a fucking blast watching that one play out. Watching the lawyers screw each other for a change.
That's a nice bit of leverage you've got with your wife's divorce lawyer, then. Bastigui smiled nastily through the smoke.
Neither of them know I know yet. I've been waiting for a good moment to tell them.
But Bastigui seemed to remember, suddenly, that Tansy might now be in possession of an even more powerful weapon in their divorce battle, and the smile faded from his crumpled face, leaving it bitter.
One last thing, said Strike. The night that Lula died, after you'd followed your wife down into the lobby and brought her back upstairs, did you hear anything outside the flat? I thought your whole fucking point is that you can't hear anything inside my flat with the windows closed, snapped Bastigui. I'm not talking about outside in the street. I'm talking about outside your front door. Tansy might have been making too much noise to hear anything, but I'm wondering whether, when the pair of you were in your own hall, perhaps you stayed there trying to calm her down once you got her inside. You heard any movement on the other side of the door? Or was Tansy screaming too much?
She was making a fuck of a lot of noise, said Bastigui. I didn't hear anything.
Nothing at all?
Nothing suspicious, just Wilson running past the door.
Wilson?
Yeah.
When was this?
When you're talking about, when we got back inside our flat.
Immediately after you'd shut the door?
Yeah.
But Wilson had already run upstairs while you were still in the lobby, hadn't he?
Yeah.
The crevices in Bestigwa's forehead and around his mouth deepened. So when you got to your flat on the first floor, Wilson must have been out of sight and earshot already.
Yeah.
But you heard footsteps on the stairs immediately after closing your front door. Bestigwa did not answer. Strike could see him putting it all together in his own mind for the very first time.
I heard, yeah, footsteps running past, on the stairs.
Yes, said Strike. And could you make out whether there was one set or two? Bestigwa frowned, his eyes unfocused, looking beyond the detective into the treacherous past.
There was one. So I thought it was Wilson, but it couldn't. Wilson was still up on the third floor, searching her flat. Because I heard him coming down again afterwards, after I'd called the police. I heard him go running past the door. I forgot that, said Bestigwa,
and for a fraction of a second he seemed almost vulnerable.
I forgot. There was a lot going on. Tansy screaming.
And of course you were thinking about your own skin, said Strike briskly, inserting notepad and pen back in his pocket and hoisting himself out of the leather chair. Well, I won't keep you. You'll be wanting to call your lawyer. You've been very helpful. I expect we'll see each other again in court. Chapter 13 Eric Wardle called Strike the following day.
I phoned DB, he said curtly.
And? Said Strike, motioning to Robin to pass him pen and paper. They had been sitting together at her desk, enjoying tea and biscuits, while discussing the latest death threat from Brian Mathers, in which he promised, not for the first time, to slit open Strike's guts and piss on his entrails.
He got sent a customised hoodie by Sommet, handgun in studs on the front and a couple of lines of DB's own lyrics on the back.
Just the one?
Yeah.
What else? Asked Strike.
He remembers a belt, a beanie hat and a pair of cufflinks.
No gloves?
Wardle paused, perhaps checking his notes.
No, he didn't mention gloves.
Well, that clears that up, said Strike.
Wardle said nothing at all. Strike waited for the policeman to either hang up or impart more information.
The inquest is on Thursday, said Wardle abruptly, on Rochelle Onifade.
Right, said Strike.
You don't sound that interested.
I'm not.
I thought you were sure it was murder.
I am.
But the inquest won't prove that one way or the other. Any idea when her funeral's going to be?
No, said Wardle irritably.
What does that matter?
I thought I might go.
What for?
She had an aunt, remember? Said Strike.
Wardle rang off in what Strike suspected was disgust.
Bristow called Strike later that morning with the time and place of Rochelle's funeral.
But Alison managed to find out all the details, he told the detective on the telephone. She's super efficient.
Clearly, said Strike.
I'm going to come to represent Lula. I ought to have helped Rochelle.
I think it was always going to end this way, John.
Are you bringing Alison?
She says she wants to come, said Bristow, though he sounded less than enamoured of the idea.
I'll see you there, then. I'm hoping to speak to Rochelle's aunt if she turns up.
When Strike told Robin that Bristow's girlfriend had discovered the time and place of the funeral, she appeared put out. She herself had been trying to find out the details at Strike's request, and seemed to feel that Alison had put one over on her.
"I didn't realise you were this competitive," said Strike, amused.
"Not to worry. Maybe she had some kind of head start on you."
"Like what?"
But Strike was looking at her speculatively.
"What?"
repeated Robin, a little defensively.
"I want you to come with me to the funeral."
"Oh,"
said Robin.
"Okay. Why?"
She expected Strike to reply that it would look more natural for them to turn up as a couple, just as it had seemed more natural for him to visit Vashti with a woman in tow. Instead, he said, "There's something I want you to do for me there." Once he had explained, clearly and concisely, what it was that he wanted her to do, Robin looked utterly bewildered.
"But why?"
"I can't say."
"Why not?"
"I'd rather not say that either."
Robin no longer saw Strike through Matthew's eyes, no longer wondered whether he was faking or showing off, or pretending to be cleverer than he was. She did him the credit now of discounting the possibility that he was being deliberately mysterious. All the same, she repeated, as though she must have heard him wrongly,
"Brian Mathers?"
"Yeah."
"The death threat man?"
"Yeah."
"But," said Robin, "what on earth can he have to do with Lula Landry's death?"
"Nothing," said Strike, honestly enough. "Yet."
The North London crematorium where Rochelle's funeral was held 3 days later was chilly, anonymous, and depressing. Everything was smoothly non-denominational, from the dark wood pews and blank walls, carefully devoid of any religious device, to the abstract stained glass window, a mosaic of little jewel-bright squares. Sitting on hard wood, while a whiny-voiced minister called Rochelle Roselle, and the fine rain speckled the gaudy patchwork window above him, Strike understood the appeal of gilded cherubs and plaster saints, of gargoyles and Old Testament angels, of gem-set golden crucifixes. Anything that might give an aura of majesty and grandeur, a firm promise of an afterlife, or retrospective worth to a life like Rochelle's. The dead girl had had her glimpse of earthly paradise, littered with designer goods and celebrities to sneer at, and handsome drivers to joke with, and the yearning for it had brought her to this. 7 mourners, and a minister who did not know her name. There was a tawdry impersonality about the whole affair, a feeling of faint embarrassment, a painful avoidance of the facts of Rochelle's life. Nobody seemed to feel that they had the right to sit in the front row. Even the obese black woman wearing thick-lensed glasses and a knitted hat, who Strike assumed was Rochelle's aunt, had chosen to sit 3 benches from the front of the crematorium, keeping her distance from the cheap coffin. The balding worker whom Strike had met at the homeless hostel had come, in an open shirt and a leather jacket. Behind him was a fresh-faced, neatly suited young Asian man, who Strike thought might turn out to be the psychiatrist who had run Rochelle's outpatient group. Strike, in his old navy suit, and Robin, in the black skirt and jacket she wore to interviews, sat at the very back. Across the aisle were Bristow, miserable and pale, and Alison, whose damp, double-breasted black raincoat glistened a little in the cold light. Cheap red curtains opened, the coffin slid out of sight, and the drowned girl was consumed by fire. The silent mourners exchanged pained, awkward smiles at the back of the crematorium. Hovering, trying not to add unseemly haste of departure to the other inadequacies of the service, Rochelle's aunt, who projected an aura of eccentricity that bordered on instability, introduced herself as Winifred, and then announced loudly, with an accusatory undertone,
"There's sandwiches in the pub. I thought there would be more people."
She led the way outside, as if brooking no opposition, up the street to the Red Lion, the 6 other mourners following in her wake, heads bowed slightly against the rain. The promised sandwiches sat, dry and unappetizing, on a metal foil tray covered in cling film, on a small table in the corner of the dingy pub. At some point on the walk to the Red Lion, Aunt Winifred had realized who John Bristow was, and she now took overpowering possession of him, pinning him up against the bar, gabbling at him without pause. Bristow responded whenever she allowed him to get a word in edgeways, but the looks he cast toward Strike, who was talking to Rochelle's psychiatrist, became more frequent and desperate as the minutes passed. The psychiatrist parried all Strike's attempts to engage him in conversation about the outpatients group he had run, finally countering a question about disclosures Rochelle might have made with a polite but firm reminder about patient confidentiality.
"Were you surprised that she killed herself?"
"No, not really. She was a very troubled girl, you know, and Lula Landry's death was a great shock to her." Shortly afterwards, he issued a general farewell and left. Robin, who had been trying to make conversation with a monosyllabic Allison at a small table beside the window, gave up and headed for the ladies. Strike ambled across the small lounge and sat down in Robin's abandoned seat. Allison threw him an unfriendly look, then resumed her contemplation of Bristow, who was still being harangued by Rochelle's aunt. Allison had not unbuttoned her rain-flecked coat. A small glass of what looked like port stood on the table in front of her, and a slightly scornful smile played around her mouth, as though she found her surroundings ramshackle and inadequate. Strike was still trying to think of a good opener when she said unexpectedly, "John was supposed to be at a meeting with Conway Oates's executors this morning. He's left Tony to meet them on his own. Tony's absolutely furious." Her tone implied that Strike was in some way responsible for this, and that he deserved to know what trouble he had caused. She took a sip of port. Her hair hung limply to her shoulders, and her big hands dwarfed the glass. In spite of a plainness that would have made wallflowers of other women, she radiated a great sense of self-importance.
"You don't think it was a nice gesture for John to come to the funeral?" asked Strike.
Allison gave a scathing little a token laugh. "It's not as though he knew this girl."
"Why did you come along, then?"
"Tony wanted me to." Strike noted the pleasurable self-consciousness with which she pronounced her boss's name.
"Why?"
"To keep an eye on John."
"Tony thinks John needs watching, does he?"
She did not answer.
"They share you, John and Tony, don't they?"
"What?" she said sharply. He was glad to have discomposed her.
"They share your services, as a secretary."
Oh, no. I work for Tony and Cyprian. I'm the senior partner secretary."
"Ah. I wonder why I thought you were John's, too."
"I work on a completely different level," said Allison. "John uses the typing pool. I have nothing to do with him at work."
Yet romance blossomed across secretarial rank and floors. She met his facetiousness with more disdainful silence. She seemed to see Strike as intrinsically offensive, somebody undeserving of manners, beyond the pale.
The hostel worker stood alone in a corner, helping himself to sandwiches, palpably killing time until he could decently leave. Robin emerged from the ladies and was instantly suborned by Bristow, who seemed eager for assistance in coping with Aunt Winifred.
"So, how long have you and John been together?" asked Strike.
"A few months."
"You got together before Lula died, did you?"
"He asked me out not long afterwards," she said.
"He must have been in a pretty bad way, was he?"
"He was a complete mess." She did not sound sympathetic, but slightly contemptuous.
"Had he been flirting for a while?"
He expected her to refuse to answer, but he was wrong. Though she tried to pretend otherwise, there was unmistakable self-satisfaction and pride in her answer. "He came upstairs to see Tony. Tony was busy, so John came to wait in my office. He started talking about his sister, and he got emotional. I gave him tissues, and he ended up asking me out to dinner." In spite of what seemed to be lukewarm feelings for Bristow, he thought that she was proud of his overtures. They were a kind of trophy. Strike wondered whether Allison had ever, before desperate John Bristow came along, been asked out to dinner. It had been the collision of two people with an unhealthy need. "I gave him tissues, and he asked me out to dinner." The hostel worker was buttoning up his jacket. Catching Strike's eye, he gave a farewell wave and departed without speaking to anyone.
"So how does the big boss feel about his secretary dating his nephew?"
"It's not up to Tony what I do in my private life," she said.
"True enough,"
said Strike. "Anyway, he can't talk about mixing business with pleasure, can he? Sleeping with Cyprian May's wife as he is." Momentarily fooled by his casual tone, Alison opened her mouth to respond. Then the meaning of his words hit her, and her self-assurance shattered.
"That's not true," she said fiercely, her face burning. "Who said that to you? It's a lie. It's a complete lie. It's not true. It isn't."
He heard a terrified child behind the woman's protest.
"Really?
Why did Cyprian May send you to Oxford to find Tony on the 7th of January, then?"
"That... it was only... he'd forgotten to get Tony to sign some documents, that's all."
"And he didn't use a fax machine or a courier because..."
"They were sensitive documents."
"Alison," said Strike, enjoying her agitation,
"we both know that's balls.
Cyprian thought Tony had sloped off somewhere with Ursula for the day, didn't he?"
"He didn't. He hadn't."
Up at the bar, Aunt Winifred was waving her arms, windmill-like, at Bristow and Robin, who were wearing frozen smiles.
"You found him in Oxford, did you?"
"No, because..."
"What time did you get there?"
"About 11, but he'd..."
"Cyprian must have sent you out the moment you got to work, did he?"
"The documents were urgent."
"But you didn't find Tony at his hotel or in the conference centre?"
"I missed him," she said in furious desperation, "because he'd gone back to London to visit Lady Bristow."
"Ah," said Strike, "right. Bit odd that he didn't let you or Cyprian know that he was going back to London, isn't it?"
"No,"
she said, with a valiant attempt at regaining her vanished superiority.
"He was contactable. He was still on his mobile. It didn't matter."
"Did you call his mobile?"
She did not answer.
"Did you call it and not get an answer?"
She sipped her port in simmering silence.
"In fairness, it would break the mood, taking a call from your secretary while you were on the job."
He thought that she would find this offensive, and was not disappointed.
"You're disgusting. You're really disgusting," she said thickly,
her cheeks a dull dark red with the prudishness she tried to disguise under a show of superiority.
"Do you live alone?" he asked her.
"What's that got to do with anything?"
she asked, completely off balance now.
"Just wondered." "So you don't see anything odd in Tony booking into an Oxford hotel for the night, driving back to London the following morning, then returning to Oxford again in time to check out of his hotel the next day?"
"He went back to Oxford so that he could attend the conference in the afternoon," she said doggedly.
"Oh, really? Did you hang around and meet him there?"
"He was there,"
she said evasively.
"You've got proof, have you?"
She said nothing.
"Tell me," said Strike, "would you rather think that Tony was in bed with Ursula May all day, or having some kind of confrontation with his niece?"
Over at the bar, Aunt Winifred was straightening her knitted hat and retying her belt. She seemed to be preparing to leave. For several seconds, Alison fought herself, and then, with an air of unleashing something long suppressed, she said in a ferocious whisper,
"They aren't having an affair. I know they aren't. It wouldn't happen. Ursula only cares about money. It's all that matters to her, and Tony's got less than Cyprian. Ursula wouldn't want Tony. She wouldn't."
"Oh, you never know. Physical passion might have overpowered her mercenary tendencies," said Strike, watching Alison closely. "It can happen. It's hard for another man to judge, but he's not bad-looking, Tony, is he?"
He saw the rawness of her pain, her fury, and her voice was choked as she said,
"Tony's right. You're taking advantage. In it for all you can get. John's gone funny. Lula jumped. She jumped. She was always unbalanced. John's like his mother. He's hysterical. He imagines things. Lula took drugs. She was one of those sort of people, out of control, always causing trouble and trying to get attention. Spoilt. Throwing money around. She could have anything she liked, anyone she wanted. But nothing was enough for her."
"I didn't realize you knew her."
Tony's told me about her."
"He really didn't like her, did he?"
"He just saw her for what she was. She was no good. Some women," she said,
her chest heaving beneath the shapeless raincoat.
Aunt.
A chill breeze cut through the musty air of the lounge as the door swung shut behind Rochelle's aunt.